Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Off the west coast of Canada, a small village on the rain-swept island of Haida Gwaii secretly dumped iron into the ocean to create a giant plankton bloom visible from space. They hope to feed declining salmon, but documents show they wanted to recoup millions of dollars by creating carbon credits for sale. Their alleged chief scientist is American Russ George, the former CEO of the notorious Planktos Corporation. I'm Alex Smith. We are looking into whether the science organized by Russ George is credible, given his past history. In fact, there are several versions of Russ George. The first is a tree planter, and his experience is strong there, there's no doubt about it. But you can also find Russ George in his persona as a self-taught nuclear scientist, expert, and businessman in the field of nuclear fusion. His company D2 Fusion sold stocks, which crashed, and promised products, which never appeared. On YouTube, there is a presentation by Dr. Russ George to the American Chemical Society in 1999. But Russ is no doctor. That's just his initials, D.R. George. Why doesn't he correct people who address him or post him as Dr. George, who think he must be one when they call him a senior scientist? In the old Masset Village presentation you heard earlier, Russ George was touted as the chief scientist on board the Ocean Pearl. That is misleading, I think. What is a scientist? In the 1800s, many scientists were gentlemen of leisure, investigating basic things. They made many important discoveries. But today, in a very complex world, we developed a university system which trains scientists and vets them. It takes many years to make a PhD doctor in any field. Russ attended the University of Utah for a few years and dropped out without a degree. That is, he is not a university graduate. Most people would find that surprising in the resume of a chief scientist. In another part of the definition of a modern scientist is the requirement to develop theories which are published in peer-reviewed journals after they've been tested. That is a check-and-balance system to make sure facts follow theory. As far as I can find out, Russ George has never been published in an accepted peer-reviewed journal. So he can make quite extraordinary statements, and the rest of the scientific community does not have to check them. None of this denies Russ George is an extraordinary man, even a brilliant one. I see him more as a kind of social and media artist with an ability to learn the language of scientific disciplines. He's also a visionary with the strength to inspire people, even a small village of people, on the wild side of the ocean. For example, let's start with this founding statement repeated often by Russ George over the years and given again in the PowerPoint provided by the old Masset Village for the Vancouver Press Conference. The slide says, quote, "Over the past half century, there has been a decline in atmospheric dust deposition from the deserts and dry lands of Asia, the most important season source of iron for the North Pacific Ocean," end quote. Really? I wondered if such a study had even been done. Looking in the references for these slides, we do find a paper, "Atmospheric Global Dust Cycle and Iron Inputs to the Ocean," by Natalie M. Mahwald of Cornell and a half dozen other world dust experts. I read the paper. It doesn't say anything about the decline of dust from Asia to the North Pacific. The paper is a key summary of all the top dust science, a survey to see what is known. Baffled that I couldn't find anything about that claim in the paper, I wrote to Natalie Mahwald over the weekend. She gave me a helpful reply almost immediately. First I asked, is this dusty statement by Russ George and echoed by the Haida Village, is it true? Her reply, quote, "Probably not. More important than dust is soluble iron from Asia, which is likely to have increased," end quote. Second, I asked, could such a statement be derived from that paper? Answer, quote, "I don't think there is anything in that paper on this." She adds, quote, "There is almost no data describing the trends in dust coming from Asia over the whole 20th century. There is some evidence that dust maximized in the 1950s in the Chinese dust sources, but that is not true of all Asia, and that data is only available after 1950 or so. What is more important for ocean iron is the amount of soluble iron going into the ocean, not dust or total iron. Several studies have suggested that economic growth in Asia has substantially increased soluble iron inputs to the North Pacific by direct emission of soluble iron from anthropogenic emissions, or by supplying acids like sulfate, which make the dust iron more soluble. And we estimate from that an increase in North Pacific soluble iron inputs from the atmosphere deposition. in this region. Sedimentary sources of iron are likely to be quite important, so that inputs from the atmosphere may not be driving phytoplankton growth. Thus, overall, I would say no, I do not agree that soluble iron inputs to the North Pacific have decreased over the 20th century, but rather have likely increased, but the uncertainty is large. End quote from a real dust scientist. So, what you say? Well, everything in the story of this ocean seeding experiment depends upon that fundamental statement that nature is not doing her job. Less dust is falling, the plankton are starving for iron, and that is why we must go out to sea and spend millions of dollars dumping iron into the ocean. But here we have their cited world expert saying that is probably not true. More iron may be available anyway due to industrial pollution. And the whole thing is not well known. There's a large uncertainty about it. With Russ George, you can be inspired if you want, but you have to check every detail of what he says. It's a heady cocktail of three-quarters truth, well worth listening to, I admit, and one-quarter exaggeration bordering on blarney.
Radio EcoShock.
Surely we're not just dealing with volcanoes and dust when it comes to salmon decline in the North Pacific. It's a shame the old Massad village people couldn't wait for the upcoming release of the comprehensive report by the Cohen Inquiry into the disappearing sockeye salmon. In my opinion, and not only in my opinion, the old Massad village leaders are also over their heads. For example, during the press conference, two actual ocean scientists from the University of British Columbia were allowed one question each with no reply or comments by them. Again, I wrote to one of the questioners, Métis Maldonado, a professor in the Earth, Ocean, and Sciences Department at UBC. She is also familiar with the fisheries on the Pacific coast and a Canada research chair in phytoplankton trace metal physiology. Métis says the Haida Salmon Restoration Project leaders were greatly oversimplifying a complex living system. After quoting from the 2010 paper by Ham et al. On the volcanic ash and anomalous plankton bloom of 2008, Métis concludes the bottom line is that yes, a volcanic eruption in 2008 enhanced phytoplankton production in the subarctic Pacific that summer and early fall, but no, there is no evidence to support that this phytoplankton bloom in August 2008 resulted in the high salmon returns of 2010. In fact, the non-scientist Russ George may have missed the target altogether on two counts. First of all, Ham et al. Says study of the volcanic eruption and plankton bloom, hardly any carbon dioxide was sequestered, quote, implying that even large-scale iron fertilization at an optimum time of year is not very efficient at sequestering atmospheric CO2. The opposite of what Russ George is telling us. Métis Maldonado adds other studies and citations showing the real cause of the sockeye salmon decline is still unknown to science. Their best guess does not focus on alleged starving salmon out at sea, but rather the growth conditions for juvenile salmon as they emerge from coastal waters. There is plenty of plankton for them there, and real scientific studies indicate there must be other factors in that nearshore environment affecting total long-term survival. Métis writes, quote, salmon survival has been linked to the quality of feeding and growing conditions during their early marine life, from smolt to adult, while the smolts are transitioning from the rivers to the open ocean. So the conditions in inlets and sounds are key, end quote. Okay, it's time to play some Russ George reality, but as I hope I've shown, apply some healthy scientific doubt to everything. Russ George is talking with Guardian newspaper journalist Martin Lukacs. We'll start with, what was the rationality for secretly pouring iron into the ocean?
The proof has been is that, you know, that sort of confirms that the collapse of primary productivity in the North Pacific is catastrophic. So if we don't do anything, we can expect to see that productivity continue to collapse into nothing. And so the whole idea of the Haida people is that, you know, somebody has to try something, right? You can't just sit back and say, well, if we do nothing, Mother Nature will take care of itself. Well, no, she won't. Yeah. She'll simply die.
It would be possible to scale this up. Is that kind of the goal?
Sure. I mean, the goal is this has got to be stewardship, right? So it's not a one-off thing. It has to happen. Since the fossil fuel age has caused a reduction of dust, which is killing the oceans, we need to replenish that dust. Mm-hmm. And we need to do it every year until we wean ourselves off of our carbon dioxide emission habit. Or face the consequences, right? The absolute certain consequence of high CO2 in the world is that our ocean dies.
How could a single Haida village perform geoengineering without getting any government permits? They claim they are the only government.
And they call and get through all of the legal processes with the, within the Haida Nation to make sure that the Haida Nation had to pass all of the appropriate legislative authority so that they could issue the appropriate, you know, ocean research permits and, you know, fisheries science permits and things so that everything was fully documented properly.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about the kind of the legal process that was followed to ensure that this was done in a safe way. What exactly was the situation with the permits? These are permits that were given to you from the Haida.
Well, so about 10 years ago, the Supreme Court of Canada heard a case where the federal government of Canada took the Haida to court and challenged their claim of sovereignty. And the Supreme Court of Canada reviewed the case. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, well, no colonial power nor Canada had ever declared war on the Haida and conquered them. And neither did the colonial government nor the current government of Canada ever even deign to offer the Haida a treaty. Mm-hmm. And since those are the only two conditions under which the Haida could have lost their original sovereignty, right, is either by being conquered or by signing it over, they had an uninterrupted claim on sovereignty in their traditional territories equal to that of Canada.
This is the 2005 Haida case, right?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, based on that, you know, if, you know, the Haida have, you know, according to the Supreme Court of Canada, have an unchallengeable claim on their on sovereignty on their territory. So, but if you're going to carry on sort of sovereign activities, the way sovereign nations do that is they pass legislation, mm-hmm. right, that empowers their administrations to administer their laws, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Ban Council, the Haida Nation is basically formed. The Haida Nation is like Canada, right? It's sort of a federal provincial organization. Mm-hmm. So it has the Council of Haida Nation is the federal government of the Haida. And the two provinces are the village of Skidigit and the village of Old Massey. And each of those, just like Canada, the Canadian government sort of does external affairs and the provinces do internal affairs. So resources are managed by the province, not by the feds. And so in order for the Haida to manage their resources, they needed to pass the appropriate laws that said they ought to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And here was the mechanism. So the Old Massey Village Council, you know, wrote and passed the laws, and quite frankly, you know, there was a cut and paste job in substantial matter from the Canadian statutes, mm-hmm. so that they were identical in every way to what was in place in the parallel sovereign government of Canada, and that empowered the Old Massey Village Council to administer this sovereign ocean territory. And so they did that, and part of what they did is then map that territory, so they drew the map of their world and declared their boundaries, and the Ban Council resolutions, which are their laws, specified that they should manage this in an appropriate way. And the way you manage research in the ocean and resources in the ocean is you demand a permit. You know, you have a process and you issue permits to do that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that was done. And such that, you know, the end result of this is that the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation was given all of the necessary and appropriate permits to do all the work that it needs to do,
mm-hmm.
right, to conduct its work, which is in keeping with what the international science community has said. This work on the oceans ought to be done under an appropriate mechanism, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well-regulated mechanism and under permit and be science. And so, indeed, it has been.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that. That's that story.
So because of these, because of Haida sovereignty, as you're saying, you never talked it over with the Canadian government, for instance.
Well, there was no. I mean, you know, we didn't talk it over with the French government or the Chinese government or anybody else, right?
Okay.
It was the sovereign affairs of the Haida.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, you know, we actually did. I mean, we had Canadian government people who have been helping us. You know, we're We're funded by the National Research Council of Canada. We've been, you know, given, you know, help and had workshops run on that we've been invited to teach us how to use satellite resources by the Canadian Space Agency. You know, we're, you know, within the federal, you know, we get lots of support from Canadian agencies because we're sort of simultaneously both HIDA and Canadian, right?
Okay.
But you choose your, you know, you choose your regulators, right? And if you only need to go to one regulator, then you go to that one, right? Nobody seeks extra bureaucracy, right?
Right.
So we had all the, you know, with the authority of the Supreme Court of Canada, we went to the bureaucracy that was the easiest for us to work with, which is the HIDA bureaucracy, right?
So who would have the kind of like copies of those permits? Would that be?
Oh, they're hanging on the wall on my office.
Okay.
In the office here in Vancouver, yeah.
Okay, oh, that's where you're located. You're located in Vancouver.
Well, we have offices at Old Macedon, but our research office, business office, is here in Vancouver.
Okay.
Who were the scientists on board? I asked that question at the press conference. At first, they dodged it, claiming privacy issues, then gave me a very short list. Here is that exchange.
Alex Smith from CFRO Radio.
Please name the scientists who were on board the Ocean Pearl for this project. You mentioned some.
The question is, name the scientists on board the fishing vessel Ocean Pearl. Jason is the operations officer, and I know he spent many weeks at sea, and it was really sunny once in the 4 weeks, I think, and there was only a 30-foot groundswell happening. So, Jason?
Russ for sure.
Russ for sure.
Yes.
Hi. We had a number of scientists. We had a number of scientists on board. Obviously, Russ George was one of our key scientists. I don't have their CVs with me.
I think there's a question of privacy of individuals. We'll get you that information. And on the video that's on here, you'll see the deckhands and the technicians that are walking around trying to deploy equipment in sea. So there was lots of people. I think we can get that information. It's not a guess. We don't want to guess here.
So you're not answering the question?
No, I'm saying we have Russ George was our chief scientist, right? We've got Peter Gross, who's our senior oceanographic engineer. He's also doubles as our sonar expert. We had plankton biologist on board named Tegan Syme. We have chemists on board. I did some of the chemistry work. And we had a number of technicians. A lot of our work was collaborative. And so a lot of the technical work was done on the ship.
Asked the same question by journalist Martin Lukacs, Russ George replied with a very short list, long on Baffelgab.
Can you tell me a little bit about the scientific team that got put together for this? Who are the other scientists who have been involved with the project?
Well, mostly people that we hire, you know, who are on staff in the company, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, we have an Australian zooplankton taxonomist, right? And we have a Canadian sonar expert who's working with our multi-frequency sonar system.
Okay.
And, you know, and a bunch of other, and other Canadians and stuff like that, right? So, you know, in different disciplines, you know, ocean chemistry, physical oceanography, chemistry, chemical oceanography, biological oceanography, physical oceanography, right? Are sort of the three principal disciplines. So we have people in all those, representing all those disciplines for it.
All the crew were undergrads, with Russ George as the supposed chief scientist. They had minimal training in high-tech equipment on board, and at one point required direct coaching by satellite by Professor Doug Campbell at Mount Allison University. Several of the crew listed their qualifications online as technical geeks with things like audio as their specialty. Sorry, I've gone through the crew list from multiple sources. There was not a single doctorate scientist on the ship. Why does this matter? It all has to do with confidence in the gathering methods and the chain of custody. At the press conference, we were told Russ George was not present because he was too busy analyzing data. Nobody really bought that. There was a bit of a hush in the room. So Russ George, whose record we know too well, is in charge of all that data? John Disney told the press, some of the data would be released for verification by independent parties. Will only supportive data be released? Who knows? Russ George bragged to one reporter that 100 PhD doctorates would emerge out of the data he had collected, the Golden Mountain. I doubt it. Who will trust it? Russ George denies there is any convention or even a moratorium against ocean fertilization.
I imagine there are some critics who are who will say that this is in violation of the United Nations CBD moratorium or the London Convention. What would be your response to that?
Well, our legal team that we hired, which are the best legal maritime and environmental law team in Canada, have examined all of that. And in fact, that is a sort of a mythology that there are that there is a moratorium. There are recommendations to create such things, but nothing has been implemented of that nature. Mm-hmm. You know, those people who have promoted that have spun it as if the recommendations from committees for the international community to implement such things is a done deal. It is not at all.
Well, maybe Russ George is right about this. Maybe the holes in international law are so big that every village, encountering hard times anywhere around the world, can start out to change the whole earth to suit themselves. This Haida Salmon Restoration Project is a wake-up call to governments to act before it is too late, to at least regulate with criminal penalties rogue geoengineering. We manage to investigate and penalize pedophiles no matter where the act takes place, but not unilateral changes to the species, to the biosphere, to the ocean. Meanwhile, Russ George continues his pursuit of fame and recognition. Here he is, off to the World Bank, to the World Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. Who is paying for those travels? The poor of Old Masset Village? For the next 10 years? But don't worry, Russ George is 100% certain their experiment has disproven all other scientific fears.
Well, it's interesting to see that the climate director of the World Wildlife Fund now says, you know, this is the thing to do. Whereas in those times, he was saying that they issued press release after press release vilifying me and that project. And now it's their idea. Thank you. You know, that's a matter of record, right? Well, you know, somebody told me the other day, you know, that science, that new discoveries in science goes through three stages. It goes through ridicule, anger, and then claim that it's their idea. And we've certainly... This topic has been ridiculed for decades. You know, I mean, John Martin's good name has been ridiculed for coming up with this in the 1980s. And in fact, he's the, you know, this wouldn't happen. This wouldn't have happened without his incredible wisdom and insight. And he was right, right? We've proved him right. So, you know, the time where people want to argue, you know, the critics of this who are people who are criticizing based on theory, not on experimental fact, have tried to prevent any facts from being obtained, right? You know, the efforts of the group that have tried to block this with, you know, by creating these London Protocol, all these efforts, they haven't been out to discover the facts. They've been, their tactic has been, do not allow knowledge on this subject to be gathered. That's what they said. There should be a ban on scientific inquiry into this. And so, and of course, that allows their theoretical position to stand as equal to the two people with facts, right? If you deny facts, then it's one theory versus another. Well, now the facts are on the table, unquestionably. Does this change the oxygen level in the ocean and produce dead zones? No, we have thousands of oxygen measurements from top to bottom, everywhere, inside our plankton bloom, outside our plankton bloom, inside other plankton blooms, outside other plankton blooms, everywhere from Vancouver north, right? We measured oxygen. Nowhere did we see in a plankton bloom a diminishment of oxygen sufficient to threaten any form of sea life. From top to bottom. So the idea that plankton blooms will deplete oxygen in the water, in the ocean, especially in the pelagic ocean, absolutely false. Best data set ever gathered in the world, absolutely conclusive to that fact, right?
There is no absolute certainty in science. Russ George can offer it to us, just as he offered absolution to the Vatican for their carbon sins, and he never delivered on that either. You can't make this stuff up in Hollywood. But I did say Ross was often right, and he can be worth listening to. Here he tells us our personal carbon pollution is killing the ocean far more than overfishing.
Our fishing industries are catching the last of the fish, right? The last of the few animals that can survive on these dwindling pastures that have lost their carrying capacity. We're fishing and catching the last of the fish there, which we call overfishing, right? But by far the greatest factor in fisheries decline on this planet is not the overfishing of the last of the fish. It's the killing of the carrying capacity of the pasture, carry the fish, right? So, you know, around the world where fish are collapsing, you know, the evidence has been very clear in ocean science that the collapse of ocean productivity inevitably leads to fewer fish, right? You know, the view of much of the world is, well, let's point our finger at the usual suspects, which is those nasty fishermen, right? When it was actually me and you and I. It's the carbon dioxide that you and I have contributed to the atmosphere of the planet through our day-to-day life that has resulted in the collapse of ocean productivity.
Russ George is also right to warn us the oceans are dying and that climate change is the major cause, and I hope that he can get that message out further. Intelligent or not, though, I can't follow Russ George or the Haida villagers to their ultimate goal. Saying the ocean is dying, George tells us humans must take over these last wild places on Earth. We'll convert the open ocean into pastures, like an agribusiness on the seas, farming plankton and the fish. We'll dump iron every year. Maybe we'll induce new genetically modified species, I'm thinking. Who knows? The dying ocean is ours to play with and command. Russ George speaks with Martin Lukacs.
You know, this is not a one-off project, right? The ocean is not saved by, you know, the ocean pastures don't change from being wildernesses where we hunt wild things to pastures where we take, where we steward them in a single project. So, you know, the Haida people, you know, we had Haida people on board and in the office, and they're learning how to do this with us, right? And so a major part of this project is an on-the-job training for the people of Old Massa, so because they need to take this on, and they understand that they need to go to sea every year and take care of their pasture, right? And if they don't do that, then the inevitable consequence of the trillion tons of carbon dioxide already emitted into the planet's atmosphere, of which a third of it has been absorbed into the ocean, and two-thirds is still yet to be absorbed. And this is regardless of whether we emit one more molecule of CO2. Right? This is yesterday's CO2 is demonstrably a lethal dose of carbon dioxide for the ocean pastures.
Is that your vision for the seas? It's not mine. I'm Alex Smith. My thanks to Martin Lukacs of The Guardian for putting his reporter's audio notes into the public domain. Be sure and check out the detailed blog for this program at ecoshock.info. I've got lots of links for you there. Download this program as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and join me again next week.